Mike's killed video. That's fine. We love you anyway, Mike. We don't record the video, so it's okay. Welcome to episode 4 of season 15 of Mention and Dispatches. And you know, of course, Mike is here in voice, though not in face, and that's probably better for everybody. Mike, how you doing tonight, man?
That is better for everybody. I'm tired, but I'm doing good. We did a podcast last night, doing one tonight, but we're going to do them until they're all done, right?
Yeah, pretty much. We're not going to record like 7 straight nights because my wife would kill me. But just the way things worked out with some technical issues on a previous episode, we recording back-to-back nights. And life goes on. We will survive and endure and have a blessedly beautiful time with it because Brian Train is back to join us tonight. Brian, how are you?
I'm doing okay. I just got back from a 2-week wargaming tour in Europe. However, I picked up a virus, I think, on the train to Switzerland. So my voice is a bit rocky, but I'm very happy to be back and happy to be talking with you guys.
And we're thrilled to have you. And I definitely want to talk to you a little bit about the how the European trip went, because I know you got to do some cool stuff while you were there. I think the last time we talked to you on the podcast was right after the Russians invaded Ukraine. And we had you and me and OJ's dad having the conversation around sort of the war games that you and I had designed like years ago around a conflict in Ukraine and how much we got wrong, really. It's sort of a 90-minute conversation of where we screwed up. But I mean, it's not a predictive business. So, you know, it wasn't a surprise that that happened. But it's been a little bit of time since we had you on the podcast. I'm glad we got you back.
It seems a very long time ago, actually, since 2022.
Yeah, no kidding. One of the main reasons we brought you back is you've got new games coming out from a couple of different places that happened to kind of all land at once. And I don't know that that was intentional. That's just sort of how the production schedules landed for the different publishers. But you've got two of the biggest publishers both dropping games from Brian at the same time. China's War is coming out from GMT, shipping now. As the GMT website says, shipping started September 24th. So I imagine those are starting to land in people's mailboxes imminently. And then Brief Border Wars 2 is the next thing in the shipping queue from Compass. Sea Power in the State just went out starting this week. So Brief Border Wars 2 will probably be next week or the week after, is when that should start shipping from Compass. So is a whole lot of Brian going to end up as Christmas presents under people's trees here? It's kind of cool.
Maybe. It is an artifact of people's publishing schedules. Both of those games have had a fairly long gestation. China's War, I got that game into about 68% towards its final form in 2015. You know, while I was still working on Colonial Twilight. Wow. But I shelved it to take time off, you know, to take time to work on Colonial Twilight and finish it off properly, which was time well spent, I think. But after that, I was working on other projects, and then COVID came and my dad died. And, you know, it's just been one thing after another since then. But GMT has had it for a while. They did take the developers off it from time to time to finish work on Red Dust Rebellion, which is another coin system game that's been very, very well received and frankly had a lot more P500 orders than mine did. So I can understand them doing it. Nevertheless, just an absolutely stellar pair of guys to work with. And I'm very, very happy, you know, that it came out as well as it has. I think people are going to be really pleased. And as for Brief Border Wars 2, I started work on that in like 2020. And through one, you know, thing or another, it's been kind of hung up in their pipeline, and it's finally coming out. And I got my advance copy of Brief Border Wars while I was away in Europe, and it's very nice. It's they did a great job with the components.
Yeah, I look. It was one of the first of the games to come out from the current publishers to sort of reboot that quad game aesthetic, the visual aesthetic of it all. The first Brief Border Wars. And I remember getting it and going, that is cool. That is exactly it. I mean, it wasn't one of the big flat packs, the SPI flat packs, but aesthetically, the standard rules folder, the game-specific rules folios, it was exactly the kind of material package that appeal to the nostalgist in many of us, me included.
Yeah. as Pee Wee Herman used to say, I meant to do that.
Yes.
It was, yeah, definitely. I mean, the quad games were always one of SPI's best-selling items, and they put together 16 of them. I spent some time a while back going through back numbers of moves and strategy and tactics to find out all of the ideas for quad games that were proposed but were never published, you know, due to, you know, like people just didn't take up or they couldn't find anybody to work on them. And there were like 40 or 50 ideas for quad games, you know, so there was like easily 100 quad type games that were never designed, or which might have come out, you know, like other games without the quad treatment might have come out later, you know, in one form or another on the same battles. But by and large, no, it wasn't like that. But I always liked the idea of having a standard rule set with some exclusive rule sets, you know, to add on. And I've done that actually twice, three times, counting the two volumes of Brief Border Wars. I also did it with Hollandspiel, because I put out a series of four counterinsurgency games with them, operational level, diceless counterinsurgency games in something called the District Commander system. And yep. Those came out one by one in boxes over several years, but they have one standard rules book, and about half of the counter sheet is common to all of the games, and then there's exclusive rules for each particular conflict and a special counter sheet for each conflict. So I really like the idea. It looks like Compass is trying to pick up on that a little bit. They have an East Front Battles quad. I think John Thiessen has been working on it, but they haven't put it out yet. And Decision Games kind of opted for the shotgun approach, in that they've got dozens and dozens of these folio games, you know, that fit into one or another of, you know, like three or four sort of periodic, you know, standard rule sets. You know, there's modern,
the fire and movement rules, the musket and saber rules. Yeah.
Yeah. So, but they never put them together as quads, whereas SPI would release them as quads, but they would also release them as individual folios as well. You know, one of the first war games I ever bought with my own money was Bundeswehr, you know, on its own in folio format from the old Modern Battles 2 quad. And boy, I liked it, and boy, I was away. That was a long time ago.
Was it the big folio, or was it the little half-size Moments in Conflict digest-sized one?
The little folded in half size, but I didn't mind. You know, it was it was good. Yep.
You probably didn't know. So last spring it was this past spring. So back in, what was it? April, I think. Mike, when were we at Buckeye Game Fest? It was April, wasn't it? Or was it May?
Yeah, I think it was April. It was later this year. Later this year, right?
Yeah. Mike and I were part of the SPI Quad Fest that we ran at Buckeye Game Fest. We scheduled seven different quads over the course of 3.5-4 days or so. We had Gary Ardwolf Lair joined the fun. Bill Simone joined the fun with that. And we actually, the promotional materials, we mocked up to look like one of the quad games with the logos from Mike's channel and our channel. And Ardwolf and the Buckeye Game Fest logo were the four boxes on the quad thing. And we did Island War. We did the 30 Years quad. We did, oh, there it is. Mike's got the t-shirt he's holding up in front of the camera there.
And, I can do it right.
So we mocked it up to be Quad Fest at Buckeye Game Fest. And we covered a lot of ground. But the whole point was, like you said, I mean, these are great games. There were a ton of them. They play quick. We sort of gave the participants the choice of, hey, we've got all of these different games. Which one do you want to do? Because they all teach fairly fast. And that's what we did for 3.5 days or so, is we just sat there and played quad games, kind of took over a table and did nothing but quads for a long weekend. We have to figure out some sort of cool theme for this coming Buckeye Game Fest, but it was a lot of fun, and it was instantly recognizable for the folks that have been around for a while. We had, you know, we had players for all the games, full tables for them. It was a good time.
I, you know, no matter what the theme is next year, I hope you do it again. And these games, they're actually really good introductory items. Dunnigan wrote in Strategy and Tactics a long time ago that when someone came to him, you know, wanting to be a game designer, the testing out project that he gave him would be a quad game often.
Yep.
And so that's where a number of designers, you know, got their start. You know, Greg Kostikian, for example, Mark Herman, I think his one of his first projects was Chinese Farm, you know, which was sort of a quad style game, you know, those sorts of things. And yeah, definitely. And as for the visual look of the thing, you know, I insisted with Mark Mahaffey, you know, who was the artist for Volume 1, to imitate that four box look as much as he possibly could. Knut Grunitz has worked on, he did the art for Volume 2, and, you know, he was amenable to it as well, you know, yeah, Compass is certainly, you know, they're agreeable to that. A friend of mine, David Burden, he's a British fellow who's actually doing a PhD in urban wargaming. We meet at these connections conferences from time to time, and he put together a joke graphic using that four box format of four different games on urban warfare that were you know, on display and being demoed at last year's Connections UK. So that was a good joke too.
Yeah, I remember him sharing that on the socials, because he's one of the folks that I follow with that. Again, like the Dragoons, we cover the professional wargaming space as well. So that is something that we track and follow. And that was something that we, you know, when I saw that, all right, I know exactly what he's doing with this. And and it was pretty cool.
Yeah. And speaking of professional military education, they are really good introductory games for these sorts of things. Jim Lacey at the, I think he's still at the Army War College, or I'm not sure exactly where Jim Lacey is right now. I remember him having, asking people for spare copies of quads because he wanted to put together like a competitive quad game ladder, you know, among the students.
Oh, wow. That's cool.
Whatever institution he was working at the time, you know, Napoleon at War, and having kind of a competition ladder. So I thought that was a great idea.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure he's still at the Army War College, but I'm not going to like kill the extra bandwidth on my computer trying to find him at the moment. We'll look him up. We'll figure it out. One of the cool things, so I've used the original Brief Border War. I mean, obviously, 2's not out yet, so I couldn't do that. But I've used the original one at conventions quite a few times over the years. It's an easy event to put on the schedule for conventions because, again, as noted, they play quick. There's a common set of rules, a common engine underneath them all that once you know that, you could teach any of the games. And then at that point, you're just making sure that the players are following the game specific rules, but it's very easy to get folks up and running and then let them self supervise when you are the GM for one of those games at a convention. And so I've done Brief Border Wars at Buckeye Game Fest. I've done it at the Fall Assembly. I've done it for Origins in the past. It's a very good package to have a variety of options for the players. And it fits within a good, convenient time box that folks get a good game experience out of it and plenty of time to do other things throughout the day. They're not feeling cheated like it was too short for something. One of the things that I also thought was great about it is the only shared components between any of the games in there are the deck of cards and the game turn marker, which you can always use something else as the turn marker. So I wrote to Compass and said, hey, I've been doing this a bunch at conventions. Any chance I can get an extra deck of cards so I can do two games simultaneously? And they sent me another deck of cards. So I've got two decks in my Brief Border Wars 1 box, and I've been able to run two simultaneous games in the past with no real issue. It's worked out really well. I think it's turned out to be a great convention package, and I don't know if that was intentional on your part, but it's worked out. So,
well, I didn't make it specifically for conventions. You know, personally, I don't go to many conventions. I go to the Consum World Expo in Tempe, or rather, I did until this year. I didn't go this year. Right. I don't think I'll be going again. My friend Rob Bottos runs a small convention in Vancouver in November, so I'll be taking Brief Border Wars there for that. Certainly, it's an ideal item for these things because it plays so fast. I don't know if you could cram one into a lunch hour, you know, maybe if you had things set up and ready to go beforehand. But certainly it can play that quickly. One thing I have discovered, actually, though, is that it is very quick to play once people know the system. But a number of questions that I got especially when Brief Border Wars 1 came out, was people subconsciously porting over rules in their head from other games that they had played. So I had to explain to people patiently things like, well, look, there is no stacking as such in this game, you know, this sort of thing. There's no zones of control or whatever. So there's a certain number of things that older hands, you know, will have to kind of unlearn in order to play this one quickly.
Not paying attention to the visual terrain in the box, but paying attention to the little terrain icon. That was one of the ones I had to overcome.
So it's just, it's little things like that, you know. I mean, and I find that even with the coin system games, you know, there's so many volumes in the system now that people are unconsciously porting over rules from earlier coin system games, you know, into whatever it is that they're playing now. Everybody does it to some degree. I'm surprised, you know, that we're not all still playing Napoleon at Waterloo. At least in our heads. So
I do it all the time, especially on the channel when I'm recording a video. I've got so many game rules in my head that I will catch myself doing something from another game. You know, it's like, oh my God.
This is the thing. There's kind of a conventional lexicon, a conventional library of mechanisms and terms and concepts that port over between and among a lot of conventional warfare games. In my tour, I was at Connections UK in London, and then another conference on urban warfare in Lausanne in Switzerland. But in between, I went to Turin, and I gave a lecture at the University of Turin about game design. And the thesis of my talk was about how games on irregular warfare so often break or just don't abide by that kind of common lexicon of terms, concepts, and mechanisms. You know, in my view, they do a better job of mirroring war than the conventional conventions do. But certainly it's something to keep in mind.
So I don't know that this got fixed for Brief Border Wars 2. I won't know until my copy shows up at the local game store here and I go pick it up.
Oh, I can tell you that.
How many dice come in the box?
Say again?
How many dice come in the box?
12.
Okay, so they fixed that problem.
Because
there were times in the first volume where you're rolling 11 dice versus 8 dice for the two sides in the battle and the game shipped with 2.
Yeah,
that's a lot of dice.
Well, actually, you know, we fix that problem in two ways. We fix that problem in volume 2 in two ways. One, we gave you 12 dice in the box, but I also made up a card that tells you how to roll for any number of dice using only 2 dice. So it works off a D66, and as a matter of fact, it's a little bit better because it avoids the extreme results that are possible if you're rolling a large number of dice. So it tends to be a little bit more normed statistically. So yeah, so you can use 2 dice or a dozen dice.
You know. Brant doesn't really need dice. He's like me. He probably has enough dice to fill a 20-gallon fish tank. I don't think he needs any more dice.
Oh, I have enough dice to fill a dumbbell.
I mean, everybody's like that. But they ship with a dozen dice, and they're good big half-inch dice, you know, black and white. So
Mike is correct in that I do not lack for dice. My wife consistently gives me shit about how many dice that I have, and then I will always come back from a game convention with more dice because that's just that's who I am. I can't help it. That said, specifically for Brief Border Wars, and specifically because I use it so much at different events, whether it's conventions or just my local war game days here, I went out and I bought a brick of the little Chessex 12 or 14 millimeter dice where you get like 36 of them in the brick, specifically to have those dice for Brief Border Wars. And I've got about 20 of them in that box. I have got a little dice pouch, and those are the ones that stay in that box.
Not only that,
I always need them.
not only that, there's any number of free smartphone apps out there that will roll dice for you, and they can even do things like color. You know, like for example, in Brief Border Wars, a 5 or a 6 on the dice is a hit.
Yep.
So you could get it to sort them, you know, so you can see instantly how many 5s and 6s you got, or you can get it to color 5s and 6s differently or something like that. So
I've tried but I've got to chuck the physical dice. I can't do the digital thing.
Yeah, me too. In the end, I'm a tactile guy. You know, I like to I like to roll them, whether it's two dice or 12. I like to roll them.
There's something about rolling those dice.
If you tell my wife that there is a smartphone dice app roller, we are no longer friends. That was, to me, that was the biggest issue with the original Brief Border Wars package. And I was curious if or how it got fixed for the second volume. I am glad to hear that there are more dice in there. I'm interested in seeing the mechanic that you've got for using the D66 to modify that for the other die rolls.
I didn't invent it. I found it off a guy's website. It's called Deep Fried Happy Mice. So look that up online, you'll see his method for doing that. We've got a card in there so that if you've only got two, if you're stingy about it, then you can do it that way.
Since we're doing a bit of a deeper dive on the Brief Border Wars series, something that I've wondered about for a while and knew that eventually I would have you back on a show or an interview where I'd get a chance to poke at you a little bit and ask, I do enjoy the card-driven mechanism of the player having to make a choice between the move value versus the attack value, how many different units you get, and you get one or the other on the card. So for the audience that hasn't seen the game, each card has two values on it. There will be a move value or an attack value. They've both got numbers, and so that's the number of units that can either move or attack when you play that card. They don't get to do both, so you've got to be a little judicious about moving people into place and then playing your attack cards. But of course, the quantities are different on all of them, so you've got to kind of juggle what you're doing each turn. I like the fact that you're forcing players to make those choices, but I also like the fact that when you sort the cards out each turn, the cards on the back are either gray or white, and you deal out the same number of cards each turn, but the players may have an unequal number of cards between them when you sort them into the gray player and the white player. What was the impetus behind the mechanism? Not so much of the choice of either move or attack, because there's a variety of games that have that, but the probable inequitable distribution of cards from turn to turn, knowing that it would get made up later in the game somewhere because there's an equal number of cards across the game itself. Where did that come from, and how was that received when it was initially tested, and, you know, sort of how did that develop over time?
Well, where did it come from? My own perversity, I guess. because what I wanted to do was I wanted to put players, you know, largely in the role of chaos managers, because the conflicts that we have in both Volume 1 and Volume 2, the situations are not perfect. The armies involved are, you know, composed generally of low-grade troops, or the situation is itself very chaotic, or logistically both sides are at the end of their tether. Either way, you know, things are not going to run well for either side. The situations that I chose are, you know, they have some circumscriptions around them, which also, you know, yields to that. so basically, yeah, I wanted the players to be kind of in the role of chaos managers. And you're right, the structure of the gray deck and the white deck are identical in numbers and values of cards between combat and movement and that sort of thing. What is random in the game is when you shuffle the cards, the order in which the cards come out. So the good thing is, though, is that each card has two values. So there isn't, like in a very, very early iteration of the game, which was the Little War, about the Hungarian-Slovakian War in 1939. That came out in a two-game set by Hollenspiel. And then later on, I took the game and turned it into, you know, the system that we do with Brief Border Wars. So you're not completely shut out of doing things. You can always, take like a card that is a high value for combat also has a value for movement, but it's definitely a lower value. So if it's more urgent for you to move your stuff around than to fight, at any particular time, then you can do that, just not with as much efficiency as you would. Also, the number of cards that you get at the beginning of each turn will vary. Sometimes you might get six, sometimes you might get only one to use. But again, that's okay, because at some point you will get more than the other guy, because there is an equal number of cards to come out. And each player starts the game with a fixed number of special action cards, which allows you to do things like, you know, things that are they key into special rules in the game, or to rest and refit your units, you know, that sort of thing. So, you know, there's always something for you to do. You're never completely shut out. However, it can feel like the chaos is biting you in every soft part of your body. And, you know, obviously, people who complain about the system say, oh, well, I lost just because the cards were bad. You know, I got a bad card and everything went head over heels and I lost. But of course, if anybody ever wins the game, it's because they were so skillful. It's not because the cards broke their way. It's because I'm a stud, so
yes,
I can manage the chaos.
It is intelligence failures and maneuver successes. Those are the only kinds of operations out there. Mm-hmm. So, as you are putting together, one of the things that I know about the games that you design is that you do spend quite a bit of time on the research of the game ahead of the design itself. That figuring out what's the proper way to capture the dynamic of that conflict. And in some cases, I think it was Tupamaro, like there's no map. There's a series of tracks and boxes and things that you are attempting to manage throughout the game, because that's how you had figured the dynamic of the conflict mattered. In the case of the brief border wars themselves, like the 2006 conflict in Lebanon from the first volume, it had a lot of coverage of it just because that's the media age in which we live. The soccer war in Central America, not as much necessarily. And the four that you've got in Brief Border Wars 2, I'm betting most folks, most normal wargamers, even a reasonably history literate wargamer, has heard of probably at most one of the four battles in there. What did you go digging up for the research, especially for Volume 2? What were the sources that you were hunting down for these things? How many of them were actually in English? What was the inspiration behind why you picked those four? Like, were those four the only ones that you could find sources for, or were they ones that tickled your fancy for a specific reason? How did we end up with those, and what were you digging for sourcing?
Yeah, well, the thing is, I had the particular ones that I had in mind. You know, I picked them, and I didn't. I evaluated the conflicts themselves according to a set of four criteria, and that was there had to be a definite beginning and end to the fighting, and the shorter the better. You know, the soccer war is like 100 hours, and a couple of these games. I think the longest game in the volume two is a couple of months. There were limited aims by the combatants. So it was a war that was confined to a fairly, you know, small area. Neither side was looking to completely annihilate the other as a country. You know, following from that, there were definite political or logistical constraints on the theater of the action, which kind of limits its size and duration. And then finally, you know, if possible, a post-war geography that was largely unchanged from the pre-war configuration. So, you know, a war that ended much as it began. Most of the eight games I've got in these two volumes so far do, you know, comply with all four of those. I think maybe the only exception to that would be the Cyprus game in volume one, because that ends up with an island of Cyprus that's partitioned, you know, into northern Cyprus, you know, a Turkish part and a Greek part. So that was how I chose them. You know, so I went looking around for conflicts that fitted those four criteria. Whether or not I would be able to find a lot of research material, you know, I kind of discovered that later after I picked something, you know, and certainly some were easier to research than others. Oh. for anybody who hasn't got their copy yet or hasn't made up their mind about doing a copy yet, there are four games in the set. One is the Second Balkan War of 1912-1913. The second one is Teschen, which is between Czechs and Poles in 1919, a one-week-long battle. Nomonhan, which is also known as Halkingal, which is Japanese and Soviets in 1939. That's probably the most famous of the battles that we've got in the box. And finally, the Italo-Greek War in 1940, which covers the initial Italian invasion and the Greek counterattack, which drove the Italians back into Albania. So it's not the entire conflict that goes until 1941. It's just the first couple of months. Teschen was the hardest, I think, to do research on. And I had to go dip into a couple of foreign language books, you know, to try and figure out you know, just things like the order of battle and to spell out if what was going on in the different battle maps, you know, where were the different centers of conflict, you know, the backs and the forths, which gave me a clue as to how to divvy up the areas on the map, you know, how to work the geography, that kind of thing. And the other wars, well, Nomonhan and the Italo-Greek War, they're pretty well documented, and they also have a few games that have been done before on that particular topic. So I think things like the order of battle, you know, at the divisional level, you know, the level that I was playing it at, it was fairly well known and fairly set. Second Balkan War was something I had to go a little further afield to get a good order of battle on these things, but it fell into place. So yeah, by and large, it did. You know, the books did set up and bark for me, and I think the games came out well. I had some good play testers, there's enough, and it, you know, as we've been talking, there's a common core set of rules here, but there are some interesting sort of special rules that are exclusive to each module. For example, in Second Balkan War, there's a little module where you can make diplomatic overtures to one or another of the great powers, Austro-Hungarian Empire or the Russians or something like that. And depending on what you do and how well you do out of that, you might end up with a couple of extra victory points, which would be really decisive because these games are very, very tight in terms of victory points and who wins. Teschen has some things like small generic combat asset units that can make a difference at a critical point, you know, so you've got a reserve of these sort of machine gun companies and little armored trains and cavalry squadrons, things that we wouldn't be wasting counters on, but could show up and make a difference to a battle at a critical point. You have control over that. And Nomonhan has some variants in it, you know, like the Japanese being a little bit, you know, a little bit more off the leash than they were historically, Japanese night fighting, Russian artillery bombardments, that kind of thing. And the Italo-Greek War has some special stuff in it as well, you know, like the Metaxas Line garrison. And there's a Mussolini's dream scenario where, you know, things go right for him, at least at the beginning, you know, but he still has lots of chances to screw it up.
Yeah. There's a little bit of flavor
in each of these games. And that's enough to keep it interesting for people, I think.
Yeah. I know we've talked about it a little bit, just you and me over the years of, you know, is there going to be a three that might just be something you do yourself and just release through your own imprint for print and play? What were some of the other conflicts that you considered for either volume one or volume two that you discarded? Either they just weren't a good fit for the model, or you might come back around to them later, but they just didn't, they didn't grab you at the right time for
one person. Volume one, you know, was pretty well set in my mind. Volume two, like Compass Games asked me for volume two pretty quickly, you know, after volume one came in. But they wanted a set of pre-1945 titles because they thought they would sell well. I've had a set of volume three titles in my mind since 2020. I haven't had the time to do the research on them as such, but if and when I do it, they will all be post-1965 titles. I have them in mind. I've changed one from my original conception. I might change it back again, depending on my research. I don't want to say what they are now because people will probably just write in and argue with me, you know, and make all kinds of suggestions. But, you know, again, I was applying the same four criteria, you know, to what I would be doing in Volume 3. As I said, I started work on Volume 2 in 2020, you know, pretty soon after Volume 1 came out, and Compass indicated they would like a Volume 2. We had everything turned in pretty promptly, and it's been, you know, I've had to wait a little while, a little bit, you know, sometimes I get a little bit impatient, I'll admit, because I'm not in this to make money, not the way a publisher has to be to make money and to continue in business. You know, really, I want my work to be out there. So I would almost prefer to have my work available in a print and play version with my own hideous primitive graphics. So that people, you know, so that the true fans, you know, could have what they wanted and had it right away. And, you know, if people knew that there was a better quality, good art, good components edition coming out later, I think that would just drive sales, you know, for the later product, because a lot of print and play customers would probably say, well, you know, this is, I like this. Well, I'm going to pick up the box copy too. So, yeah. You know, I mean, this is the thing. This is why on my website, for example, I have like a dozen or 15 games that I just have always had available for print and play, and another 5 or 6 that I offer for very cheap, you know, like $8 print and play on Wargame Vault. So that's, you know, that's a good chunk of my repertoire there, because I just want to get this stuff into other people's hands, you know. And if someone is hardcore enough to do a little craft project, you know, before they can play, well, more power to them. You know, I like that dedication.
Yeah.
Season 15 of Mentioned in Dispatches is graciously supported by all of our Patreon members, but especially our regimental patrons who supported us at the top level. The Armchair Dragoons would like to thank Miles R., James M., Kevin Bertram, Catastrophe Games, Fred and his dog, Joseph Knorr, Patrick Geraghty, Michael Sunborg, Stagger Wing, and Paul LaFontaine. Wargaming is our jam, and they help us spread it. You too can support the Regiment of Strategy Gaming as a Patreon supporter at patreon.com/armchairdragoons.
Mike, I have one more question on the brief Border Wars front, but Mike, I didn't know if you had anything you wanted to jump in here with before we shift gears.
I guess with the brief Border Wars, you know, there's a 1 and a 2. If a gamer walked into a game store and they're both sitting on the shelf, does it matter which one they have to buy the first one to enjoy the second one, you think? Or is it just pick the battles you like and go with that?
Yeah, definitely the latter. The only difference in the core rules between Volume 1 and Volume 2 is we reworded a couple rules for clarification, and the Volume 2 rules include a long example of play that we didn't have room for in the first volume.
I love to see that.
So basically, that's the only difference. I mean, there's examples of play for specific processes that were always worked into the rules, but the comprehensive whole turn example of play, you know, is a feature of Volume 2. I don't know if Compass plans to make the system rules available, you know, like the latest system available free to people through their website. That might be a nice idea for people who have just Volume 1 but would like to have the Volume 2 rules. The only other differences between Volume 1 and Volume 2 is the box for Volume 2 is a little browner. The cards have a picture of a Mauser Carbine 98 instead of an AK-47, which would be anachronistic. And the maps are printed on a heavier cardstock, which is kind of nice.
Yeah. I guess we'll have to see if we can get Brant an extra copy of the card deck for his copy whenever he gets it.
Well, I think the card deck's the same from 1 to 2, isn't it?
Oh, it's the same. You know, we just have a picture of a different rifle. That's all.
Yeah.
But the values and everything are the same. But the graphics, you know, there's some different period, you know, photograph graphics on the cards and a picture of a different rifle, you know, to fit in with the time. Because, you know, like these go from like 1912 to 1940. And, you know, if there was one weapon that was common to all the many of the armies at that time, it was the Mauser 98, you know, and of course, you know, in Volume 1, you know, they're modern. So you got the AK-47.
the last question I wanted to ask you on the brief Border Wars side of things is those criteria that you had described, especially sort of the defined start and end and relatively unchanged borders at the end of it. Obviously the Operation Attila being the exception there, but there's probably a variety of pre-World War I and probably even pre-gunpowder examples of conflicts that ended up very similar to that. Is that something that you sort of wanted to live in a post-gunpowder or 20th century era with these, or is that something that you think could work for a whole separate time period in human history?
I don't know how well it would work before telegraph and radio.
Okay.
You know, with the choices between, you know, with the size of the theaters and the choices open to the commanders, you know, or the players rather. And also I'm by inclination a modernist. You know, I prefer post 1945 everything. You know, I agreed with Compass when they thought a pre 1945 set would sell well. And it was kind of a joke because, you know, when we were a number of years ago, John Compton and I and a couple other guys were goofing around on Consum World talking about border wars that never went anywhere. And somebody brought out the example of Teschen as it's also called the 7 Days War because it was over in 1 week. An example of that particular kind of thing. And I did look into it at the time and I thought, I don't know, I don't want to do that. And then later I picked up on this 1939 Hungarian-Slovakian War as the first test of this kind of conflict. And later, of course, I did more research later on, and I went back to Teschen and actually did the game, and it's actually not too bad a situation once you pep it up with a few things. But you know, that was as far as it went. I'm more interested in modern conflicts and the particular and certainly in a modern conflict there would be more political constraints than logistical constraints, perhaps, or some of each. But you know, in an industrial age or pre-industrial age one, it just wouldn't be the same.
Yeah, I lied because I just thought of another quick question on the brief. I said that was my last question on brief Border Wars, and yet I've got one more.
Well, you've had my last answer, so we're just gonna
okay. Fair enough.
No, now I'm curious. Please.
When so Volko had created the coin system and then ended up collaborating with some other folks, and now has kind of moved on to do other things, but there's still people developing the coin games behind him. Is if somebody else came to you and said, "Hey, I'm really interested in doing a volume of Brief Border Wars using this engine. Here are the things I've got in mind." Is that something that you're, you know, hey, go forth and conquer and cheer them on, or is that something you'd rather kind of hold on to a little bit? Nah, you know, I'm really kind of wanting to keep these things a little more tightly controlled with the vision that I originally had, and not ready to let somebody else run off with it for fear of them kind of screwing up that vision that you had.
Yeah. That's a really good question. First of all, I'd be grateful to the person for even asking, because this is a very small hobby and we all kind of stand on each other's shoulders as designers. And so I think people should name check and ask permission and, you know, give little ego pats whenever they can, if they want to do stuff that's inspired by someone else's work. I'd be pretty piffed if somebody presented, you know, my intellectual property as theirs. So if somebody simply cut and pasted my standard rules and presented it as their own work, that's not on. But if somebody came to me saying, you know, look, I think this is a real clever system. I have an idea for, you know, another, you know, a set of things in another era, you know, I'd be interested. I'd like to hear them. If it was interesting enough, I might even help them with it. But I don't think I've got, you know, like it's not like like game mechanics. They're not exactly patented or anything like that. You know, I mean, if anybody holds the patent on the hexagon, it's the honeybee, and you don't want to make honeybees angry. So
no,
you know. But yeah, it's that would be interesting. You know, I'd certainly, if someone had that idea, I'd certainly like to hear from them, and I'd be ready to give them advice, you know, at least. But I don't know if anybody would want to do that. But meanwhile, my own personal inclination would just be, if I do volume three, because I haven't had the time to do it. I've been working on a lot of urban warfare, modern, like very modern contemporary urban warfare projects the last little while, and another coin system game other than China's War, which will be my very, very last essay in the system. So when I'll get around to working on volume three, I'm not exactly sure, but we'll see.
Shifting gears over to the coin system, so the first coin game was 2011, I think, is when Andy and Abyss finally got published. I remember seeing playtest copies 2010 at NDU at Connections that year. And then the next year, were you at the first Connections at NDU in 2010 or was it 2011 that I think you were there in 2010.
It might have been 2010, yeah. Actually, I playtested Andy and Abyss at Consum World Expo in 2010.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, Joel Toppin was doing it at the time, and I think they were just getting into it. And at the time, I had no idea that my work in my work in insurgency gaming, specifically my game from 2000 on the Algerian War, I had no idea that it had any influence on Volko. And it wasn't until Andy and Abyss was published and I looked at the playbook and Volko is in the designer's notes there name-checking me saying, yeah, Brian's work was very influential and, you know, definitely fed into the development of the coin system. But yeah, it was 2011, I think, at NDU. And I remember meeting up again with Rex Bryan in there after many, many years and meeting Volko. And Volko and I, you know, we got along. Well, Volko gets along with most anybody. We agreed pretty quickly that we should collaborate on something in the coin system, and that's what we did with A Distant Plane. And we went right to work on A Distant Plane in 2012, and that game came out in summer of 2013, summer fall 2013.
Yeah, it was pretty quick. I've long joked with folks that I claim 12% of the credit for A Distant Plane existing because I'm the one that put you and Volko on a panel together, which is when you guys met. And the truth is, you guys would have met at some point anyway, because you were doing so many similar things. But I've joked with folks for years that I claim 12% of the credit for why that game exists. Not that I had anything to do with any design piece of it. It's just I put the two of y'all in the room together and let y'all take it from there.
That sounds like it should be more 1.2% to me.
That's and even that's probably too high.
Well, I'm grateful for you doing that, because, you know, Volko and I think we worked together quite well on that particular project. The game came together really quickly. We had a good crew of developers and testers, and I think Gene Billingsley was interested in fast-tracking this and getting it out before NATO finished its combat mission in 2014. So that's what we did, you know. And again, you know, we were at pains in our designer's notes and elsewhere in the game to talk about how this is not a predictive game at all. What we're doing is we're just presenting you, you know, hoping you understand some of the complexities and the ins and outs of the problems, and you can explore its different dimensions. We're not telling you who is going to win or how anybody's going to win, or even in a manner of speaking, what winning really is, you know.
Yeah. It's an exploratory game,
victory conditions, but, you know, the best part of these things is debating over who actually won, you know.
Yeah. I've made no secret about it. A Distant Plane is my favorite of the set, and it's the one that I also use for the team events that we play, in large part because it suits itself so well to that team environment that's the way that I definitely like to use it.
I gave that version a shout out when I did that lecture in Turin, because I was doing it at the behest of a professor of political science at the university who uses A Distant Plane in his classes. His name is Stefano Ruzza, and he invited me to give this talk to a bunch of students. And I did specifically mention, you know, how we can introduce chaos and the unknown into a game that has no hidden information in it. We make hidden information by, making people hide, you know, willy-nilly from each other. And they were very interested in that. Unfortunately, I couldn't give him any details, but, you know, certainly if he ever tries to do it, I'll put him on to you in one of his classes.
Well, and we've got the explainer that I had written up for the website, and it's on the site. Like, it's openly available to folks in terms of the mechanics that we use to do this. I'm happy to discuss it with anybody that's interested. It's a modification that we put together in an attempt to create kind of a larger event specifically for the conventions, where you get something that's different than you would get with your local game group, either at your game store or your friends in town that you would pull together for an afternoon on a Saturday sometime. We wanted something specifically different from that you needed more of a convention infrastructure to pull off.
Yeah, I think it's a brilliant addition, because what it does is it takes each faction and subdivides them. I did something the same way with Colonial Twilight, because I developed a four-player version of Colonial Twilight, where the two players are two teams of two players, and on the French side they're split by function, and on the FLN side they're split by geography.
Oh, okay.
So but either way, yeah, and so they're kind of in rivalry with each other. So just as in a distant plane, the coalition and the government of Afghanistan are sort of friendly rivals. You know, you, of course, your thought was to subdivide each faction so that they're sort of friendly rivals within the faction itself.
Yeah,
you know, that unwittingly work against each other. And I thought that was a really good addition, because, you know, if these games are to teach us anything, it's about the nature of coalitions and alliances and factions and people with agendas inside factions, which is important. It really is.
Yeah, yeah. So at this point, we've got A Distant Plane, which has been covered a lot over the last, you know, 10 plus years or so that it's been out there. We've got Colonial Twilight, which, if I recall correctly, was the first coin game that wasn't specifically a four-player build, right?
Yeah.
So, because the original one was only a three-player game, wasn't it? Or was it a two-player?
I'm sorry?
Colonial Twilight, when it was originally published.
No, it was always two players.
Yeah, okay. So, but it was the later first of the coin games that wasn't four.
Yeah, well, that's true. It was the one that wasn't for four. But pretty soon afterwards, Vesa Arponen came out with All Bridges Burning, which is three players. So Vesa cracked the three-body problem for making that work.
And then beyond that, we've got China's War. I think the only published coin games you've had thus far were Distant Plane, Colonial Twilight, and China's War, right?
Yes.
None of the others. And we'll get to that Phantom Fourth one here in a minute. Talk to us a little bit about China's War, because that's the new one. That's the one that's going to be landing in mailboxes shortly, and that if people wanted to go order it, it's there to be bought. I find it interesting that most of the coin games, Fire in the Lake's probably the obvious exception, but most of the coin games are not taking place during sort of hot shooting wars, and yet China's War does overlap the Japanese invasion of China, which some people say was the real start of World War II. How are we juggling a counterinsurgency set of mechanisms in the midst of a shooting war?
Yeah, I mean, in a manner of speaking, some people could even argue that World War II started in 1931 with the Manchuria incident, because that was the crumbling away of the League of Nations. But anyway, yeah, you're right. This is my third published game by GMT using the coin system. And as I mentioned earlier, I started work on this in 2015, but I shelved it in order to start work on Colonial Twilight. Yeah. This is also my second game on the Sino-Japanese War from 1937 to 41. I did a game on this in 1999 called Battle for China. That was done by the Microgame Design Group. And it was republished by several. Oh, thank you. That was the last or the almost last edition for it. That was done by Fiery Dragon, which is a Canadian company. That's the very, very first one, Microgame Design Group. What a completist you are, Mike. Thanks.
The audience obviously is only listening and can't see, but Mike is busy holding up copies of old Brian Train.
It's actually this is kind of cool. The little tin from Fiery Dragon for Battle for China. I think this was like a collector's thing, right, at the time?
It is. It is. That was the hook with Fiery Dragon games for a while, is that they came in these little tin boxes. But they came from China, and too many of them arrived dented to really, you know, because they couldn't get the dents out of the boxes if they arrived in that condition. So they gave up on it. Well, actually, that version of Battle for China you have there, that's the deluxe edition. And they only made about 110 of those. So
wow.
You have one of 110. But the final
must have got a bargain on that then.
Oh, you probably did. You know, it's
and actually, wasn't there a volume two that was published later?
Well, no, there was an expansion kit. Well, at the same time as I was working on Battle for China, I was working on an expansion kit that you could bolt onto the game, and you can take the game from like the original game ends in 1941. You know, the end of 41. You know, when the war, the focus really falls away from China, and you can go from 42 to 45, and then there's another one for the Civil War, and from 46 to 49. And if you want to, you can play everything at once and just go from 37 through to 49, or whenever the communists finally, you know, finally win, or the nationalists extinguish the communist threat. And the final edition of this was Decision Games put it in Strategy and Tactics magazine. Okay, and that was the last time. And that was like 2009 or so. That was a while ago, but you know, that was four different editions by several different publishers over a period of 10 years. I thought that was pretty good. This is actually my second game on that war. So a lot of the research I had already done, you know, at that particular level, and I was already thinking about the particular,
Yeah, I think the video froze, but I don't think that your audio was still going. The question where I had been intending to go before we were so rudely interrupted and then Mike dipped into showing up was, you know, most of the coin games are taking place during a true counterinsurgency, whereas China's war, the years that are listed on the box are while the shooting war is already going on between China and Japan before the dates that the U.S. widely recognizes as the start of World War II. But certainly, World War II really kind of started in 33. And again, as you noted, could even be backed up to 31 for China and Japan. You know, for where that conflict went hot. How did you manage, like, the coin? Was it just using the coin system, or is there an actual counterinsurgency underneath the actual hot war as a part of all of this that you're building in conflict?
Yeah, this, of course, you're right. This is the first coin game, coin system game that takes place during World War II. And it's also one of the largest theaters of World War II. The map covers an area that's about 1,500 miles north-south and by 900 miles east-west. And each population point in the game represents about 10 million people. So that's by far the largest in scale of any of these. However, it's not primarily an insurgency or counterinsurgency game. Of the four factions, only the Communist Party of China is the true insurgent faction, and their structure of guerrillas and bases is pretty familiar, you know, from the early coin system titles. The nationalists, that's the central army, National Revolutionary Army, they do have some guerrilla counters, but they don't act the same way that the communist guerrillas do. There's a special action that the nationalist player can take where the nationalists can do sabotage, and they can operate against, the logistical network of railroads and rivers that the Japanese player has to conquer and dominate and maintain in order to win the game. So for the rest of it, you've got three conventional forces and one insurgent faction that are fighting each other. It's also complicated by the fact that this is an invasion scenario. We have one faction is invading a country and three factions are opposing it, and they're in a rather uneasy alliance with each other. There is a mechanic of assaulting and so forth, assaulting and ambushing that that sides can use, and it's handled by a fairly simple die roll. So it's so combat is not the deterministic thing that it is in many other coin system titles, and it's settled by a simple die roll by and large. It doesn't have the sets of die roll modifiers generally that you encounter in Harold Buchanan's Liberty or Death, or the All Bridges Burning by Vesa Harponen.
Let's go. As you were putting this together, so obviously there's sort of the coin system of, hey, we've got the each of the cards that has an event on it that you could take the event or you can bypass the event. And if you're one of the eligible factions, if you're the first one, you can choose that the action, you know, the action followed by the follow-up action by the special action following it, or if you're, you know, not eligible, obviously it doesn't matter what happens on the card, but the cards give you the turn order, kind of the right of first refusal as you go through. Do you want to act? Do you want to pass? Et cetera, et cetera. I'm assuming that sort of core underlying card-based mechanic doesn't change a lot for this game, and that's because otherwise it's not a coin game, right?
Yeah, no, it doesn't change at all. It's that basic mechanic is very, very basic to the coin system. And as you say, if we weren't using that, then it wouldn't quite be the coin system anymore. That being said, there are some other things, you know, that are in this coin system game that you don't encounter in others. For example, one thing that a lot of people who are early new learners in the coin system, when they pick up on the first few titles, is they tend not to pay much attention to the lines of communication. They tend to treat them just as boundaries between areas, so they just treat it like an area movement game. But at some point, the light goes on, and they start to see the lines of communication as a method, you know, as something to exploit and definitely something to work on. And then it turns into a different kind of game than just your ordinary area movement game. In this game, you have to get onto that from the very beginning, because the Japanese objective is crucial to dominate the network of railroads and rivers, which is, you know, the economic sinews for Japan. That was where the population was. That was where the industry and the raw materials and all those kinds of things were. And that was all that the Japanese were interested in securing. If you lived more than a few miles away from a town or a railroad or a port or anything like that, during that time, chances are you probably wouldn't see a Japanese soldier, you know, for years on end. Sometimes they would just go and they would go on sweeps through the countryside, but by and large, they just were interested in controlling that net of lines of communication. And that is their main victory condition. So there's a lot of fighting going back and forth over the lines of communication itself. That makes it mechanically somewhat different from the other coin titles without changing the mechanics themselves. But it's definitely more important than in others.
Yeah.
But there are other familiar things as well. For example, the Communist Party of China, as the single insurgent faction in the game, their victory condition consists of arousing opposition to the government plus having bases. So that's a victory condition that's familiar from other games, you know, like the Taliban and A Distant Plane,
yeah.
And the FLN and Colonial Twilight.
Yeah, yeah. As folks have, you know, you got your feedback from playtesting. Obviously, it hasn't hit the public yet, so it's tough to gauge public reception for it. But as this was going through playtesting, I'm sure there have been people with very strong thoughts, TM, right, from online sources, just like there were very strong thoughts about A Distant Plane before anybody ever saw it. But as you were going through playtesting with it, were there particular pieces of feedback you got from the playtesters that said, hey, I really like this, let's reinforce this idea or maybe build on it some? Or were there also other places where the playtesters came back and said, this ain't quite working, we need to do something to it?
Yeah. Well, the public reaction to A Distant Plane, of course, you know, you were familiar with that at the time, was mainly because the war wasn't over yet. And of course, everybody had an opinion about that. There was a very long Board Game Geek thread about that that went on and on and petered out about 150 posts in. My favorite post on that thread, though, was about two-thirds of the way in. Somebody posted just to tell us that he had no interest in modern era, no interest in Afghanistan, no interest in purchasing this game or the coin system, and he left it at that. That was so Board Game Geeky. You know, just to take the time and trouble to post and tell other people that you have no interest in what they're talking about. However, with China's war, if you go to BoardGameGeek and you see that there's a number of threads about everything about China's war except the game, because nobody had a chance to try the game or to see the game even being played. It was only a few weeks ago that there started to be some pictures emerging of a game of a map with pieces on it. But, you know, until then, everybody had an opinion on freaking fonts being used and whether or not to use Chinese characters and the dimensions of the map. And, you know, why isn't North, you know, this direction instead of that direction, and on and on and on. You know, it's like, again, you know, it aroused a lot of reaction, a lot of fervent opinions from many people, even from some Chinese people who I was happy to hear from. You know, but again, you know, it was about everything but the game itself. And now that the game itself is going out, you know, and people will get a chance to actually play it, I'm a little worried about kind of bollocking I'm going to get Ben, which is what the, you know, because until then, until now, everybody's been arguing about the amount of green on the map, or, you know, whether to use simplified Chinese or traditional Chinese characters, or, you know, because actually this whole thing has been politically quite fraught, because the flag of the Republic of China at the time in the 1930s is the flag of Taiwan nowadays, and it, technically it's illegal to display that flag in the People's Republic of China. So it was quite iffy, you know. We dithered around with graphics and terminology and stuff like that, and we were very careful to try and not to give any kind of offense, you know, in that, so that the printer, you know, who produced it in China wouldn't get into any trouble, would be willing to do the job in the first place without attracting any official attention. And that copies of the game could be sold, you know, on either side of the Strait of Taiwan, you know, both in Taiwan and in the People's Republic. Because, of course, we know there are more and more board gamers in the People's Republic, and there's a growing industry of mainland Chinese board game designers, which is great, great development. Because here I am, you know, looking, you know, granted, you know, I've done work on this, but I don't have access to primary sources because I can't read Chinese. I don't have any access to archives or anything like that. So there's a growing body of games, you know, of different periods of Chinese history that are put together by mainland Chinese and Taiwanese designers as well. So I'm happy to see that.
Ryan, I've known you for 15 years, maybe a little more at this point, that I can't possibly remember a time in which you were legitimately bothered by people yelling at you about one of your design choices.
Well, I'm getting old and cranky. I'll be 61 next month.
Yeah, but
I kind of, you know, I'm getting a little bit more aware that you know, ars longa vita brevis, and there's only so much more time that I can spend arguing with people about font choices and stuff like that.
You know, I've seen you, like, be frustrated with the fact that people were getting upset about stuff, but it never really seemed to bother you for, like, oh, my God, did I make a bad decision? It's sort of like, really, guys, this is what we're going to talk about? I mean, that's sort of been...
Yeah, that's still kind of my take on it, you know? I mean, if someone comes up with a legitimate argument as to why I should do something a certain way, you know, then I'll listen to them for sure. But don't scream your argument at me, you know, that, like that A Distant Plane thread that I mentioned earlier. Volko and I, we kept our cool. We did not scream back at the moon bats. We were cool. We were professional. And, you know, for example, there was a thread on China's war on BoardGameGeek about the map. And this Chinese, you know, this Chinese user, he posted this greed, and he was just ranting and raving about how ugly he thought the map was, and he accused it of, you know, all kinds of awful things. And you know, a while later he came back and he posted again about it, and I gave him what I thought was a very calm and measured reply, and you know, he calmed down. And he said, yeah, I see your point. You know, I mean, I'll reserve judgment on the game itself, but I see your point. I see why you did what you did and this kind of thing. So, you know, as they say, a soft answer turneth away wrath, and it worked in this case. So, yeah, sometimes I'll admit I get a little frustrated over people arguing about trivia about a game because, you know, we all put in a hell of a lot of time, you know, thinking about these things, conceptualizing them, making them work. And, you know, and then someone shakes the box and gets mad because, you know, they didn't like the ink used for the font, you know, on the cover or something like that. You know, it's superficial. Please, you know, if you're going to argue with me, listen to my argument first instead of just looking at the box top. And by and large, people generally do that. Now, you did ask a question about the playtesters and their reactions and things. We did an awful lot of tweaking during the process of development and playtesting. I don't think that there were any really major substantial changes from my original, you know, 2015, 2017 kind of version. But we did an awful lot of tweaking. One of the things we did actually was we turned up the volume on a lot of the cards to make them a viable alternate choice to doing an operation. I'll admit my tendency, you know, in a couple of these games has been to make cards that are somewhat muted, you know, in effect or power. So we made them as like a little bit more of a tempting choice for players. One faction that people couldn't, you know, I guess a number of people talked about not being able to really put their finger on it, how to use it properly, was the Communist Party of China, because it's the smallest faction in terms of pieces. It's the one with the lowest victory conditions, and of course it's an insurgent faction, so it doesn't have a lot of combat power, but it has other strengths as well. You know, so you have to think like an insurgent to do that, and to think of not like Mao Zedong will not emerge as the leader of all China by the end of 1941. Them winning the game, you know, in game terms, them winning the game in 1941 means that they have, you know, improved significantly on where they were historically in 1940-41 after the 100 Regiments offensive, and that they're in a good position for surviving the rest of the war and the civil war that's ultimately going to follow. But they're not going to overrun everything on the map. You know, for them, the victory means something a little bit different. And I think people, you know, were maybe a little bit, for some of them, it was a little bit harder to come to grips with this than the more straightforward nationalists armies fighting the Japanese armies. But then, of course, there's the warlord faction in between, which is, you know, it's against the Japanese generally, but it's not strictly under the control of the nationalist player either. They have their own agenda. So that, you know, lends a different flavor to the game as well.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think anybody that's trying to make the argument that the Communist Party of China should be sweeping the map isn't paying attention to the dates that are on the cover of the box, right? I mean, it's... You know, the game ends like 7 years before that's happening.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. So
they probably play primarily the Paradox Games, Brant, where it's the paint the world in your color, you know.
Brian, one other thing. This is a little off the beaten path of the games that you've got coming out, but it is just a quick question I wanted to throw in toward the end as we start wrapping up this conversation. There's been a couple of digital adaptations of your games over the years. Winter Thunder's out there. I think one of there was another one that I want to. It wasn't the Shelt game that you did for Hollenspiel, but I thought there was another one that had been adapted digitally. Is that something that folks have just not approached you, or you haven't gone to other folks, or you've explicitly given folks the stiff arm when they've asked about digital adaptations? We're starting to see more board games getting adapted to digital play, not Vassal or Rally the Troops tabletop simulator, but like a legit computer game. Is that just not something that's crossed your path that much, or is that something that you've kind of avoided? What's the story there?
It's something that generally hasn't crossed my path, although I haven't turned my path to try and collide with any of that. If someone has the programming knowledge and the energy and the drive to make a playable digital version of my game, as opposed to a Vassal or tabletop simulator module, and there's lots of those, of course, then, you know, I would like to hear from them. Chances are I'd say fill your boots. You did mention Winter Thunder, which is a Bulge game, Battle of the Bulge game by me. That's one that's playable by through Steam. Another fellow was working on a playable version of my third Lebanon War hypothetical game, but I think he's kind of laid that aside for other projects now. But certainly, you know, there's other attention from other people for developing modules for Rally the Troops or Tabletop Simulator Vassal, which is good, you know, because I can't program a Vassal module. I couldn't put one together to save my life. And Rally the Troops, there's a certain kind of programming knowledge that needs to be done, you know, that you need to have, and I just don't have it. Tabletop Simulator, I'm barely able to create a prototype in that myself. I'm starting to use that. I'm starting to use Tabletop Simulator for some simple prototypes of some of my games, just because, you know, again, it's I'm getting a little tired of the craft projects, you know, and it's much easier to change things by and large. I mean, if somebody wants to do that kind of a thing, and it seems to be very much the coming sort of thing, then, you know, I'd probably welcome that. You know, it would get me a lot more exposure. And some of the publishing agreements I have with some companies, you know, have language in them concerning development of digital versions of games as well. But by and large, nobody's really done it yet.
Yeah.
Well, anyway.
Yeah, I didn't know, because I know there are some designers out there that can be a little more curmudgeonly about, no, mine is intended to be a board game, and that's how it's always going to be. And they don't want it to be a digital game. They specifically want it to stay a board game. And I didn't know if, not that you were intentionally being a curmudgeon, but if that was something that you felt very strong about, or if that was something that just hadn't, you know, been offered to you in much of a way yet. So
yeah, well, chances are, you know, if somebody did something like that, I probably wouldn't play it myself. I'm not a computer war gamer. I design board war games. I'm a paper guy. You know, from paper I came, and to paper I shall return. So, but if somebody wants to put something together like that, obviously I can see the advantages of having a game like that. You don't have to. It doesn't occupy any table space. You know, you can set it up and take it very quickly. You can get with other people, you know, across the world if you can do it. More power to them. Certainly made easier to handle than a Vassal. You know, when I found Vassal has, you know, it's a wonderful thing, but, you know, learning to use it is a real, can be a real bear. I think you and I were talking a while back about the Urban Operation Planners course we're doing with the California Army National Guard. And the first couple serials of the course, we used a Vassal module that was developed by Kurt Pangrax at the U.S. Army Command and General Staff College. And it didn't work out that well just because it was so unfamiliar to the remote students on the course, because they were struggling with learning Vassal as well as trying to learn to run the game. So the last serial of the game, we avoided that, and we came up with a method of playing it using the breakout rooms function in MS Teams and PowerPoint, which was low tech and very slow, and you had to play it carefully, but it was very intuitive. You know, people could get what was going on without having to struggle with the user interface at all.
Yeah. And look,
I like low tech solutions to these kinds of things.
Yeah. Having Kurt develop the Vassal module is kind of cheating. The dude has also been an actual computer game developer in the past as well. So,
Kurt is a genius with doing these things.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Mike, what have we not hit that you wanted to ask about here?
I think we've covered just about everything I wanted to cover. I think we're I showed off my copy of Fiery Dragon Battle for China. I mean, that alone was worth it, right?
Yeah, well, but now you have to send me a picture of it that I can attach to the podcast episode so that the audio-only audience can see what it is you're waving around on the camera for the video we don't record.
Yeah, I'll have to do that because I had no idea it was that low quantity and numbers of that. So, yeah, I'll have to send you a picture.
Yeah, well, that's the deluxe edition. You know, there was another edition. You know, oh, actually, that was a, oh, yes, okay. No, what you have actually, Mike, is one that is somewhat rare in that it is the tin box. It was the deluxe edition, the 110 copy one that I mentioned. That was in the somewhat larger cardboard box version.
Ah, okay.
So there are a few of those, but there are very few of the tin box copies floating around anyway, because as I said, they only did that for a couple of years before they went to the cardboard box boxes as well. There's one other thing that I wanted to say before we go.
Absolutely.
I've said this in other places, but China's War 1937-41 will be my last GMT coin system game that I am publishing through GMT. I am about to release an adaptation of the GMT coin system game that is about modern Canadian politics, and it's called O Canada. And you know, I always thought that the GMT coin system would be very well suited to a situation of just plain power politics, not necessarily guerrilla warfare or insurgencies, but that the asymmetric mechanics and methods that have been developed in it would work very well for this kind of thing. So I'm going from the largest theater of World War II with tens of millions dead and atrocities and disease and everything, and I'm using an adaptation of that system to have like one of the least kinetic situations you can think of, modern Canadian party politics from the 1950s to, you know, the near future. In a sense, it is a reboot of the old SPI game Canadian Civil War from 1976 by James Dunnigan. But that was a four-player power politics game with very symmetrical procedures and a lot of log rolling and that kind of thing. It was very much a Dunnigan production with a lot of charts and die rolls. This is a reboot of that game via an adaptation of the GMT coin system, where you play the game on two levels. One is sort of like the level of party politics and voting blocks, and then there's like a non-material level of fighting over issues and narratives. It's got four different scenarios. It's for four different players that represent four different tendencies in Canadian politics over the years towards a stronger or weaker federal government and a stronger or weaker federation of provinces. And that will probably be my very last essay in the GMT coin system, because like Volko, I'm moving on to other things. Volko has kind of done his last GMT coin system game, and he's into his Coast Watchers and other games like that about limited intelligence and hidden information. And I think it's time for me to move on to other things as well. There's still an awful lot of energy and inventiveness in the coin system, and a lot of people are working on it. I think after three or four titles, you know, producing three or four titles myself in the series, it's, you know, other people can fill in, no problem.
Yeah. And I mean, Volko's, you know, Coast Watchers and, you know, the upcoming Draken and the other limited intelligence games that he's got, that's the second series that he's launched since the coin series, because in between he did the whole Levian campaign thing. So
yep.
He's been a busy dude lately.
He's retired, and retired people are the busiest ones I know.
Yeah, see? Mike, what's your
see? That's what I'm saying. Exactly.
Yes, but Volko is retired and busy providing us well-loved and expansive game systems that lots of people are running off with, and, you know.
And I'm providing great playthroughs of these games that he's designing, so that's what I'm doing.
Fair enough. Brian, thank you very much for the time. We really appreciate it, especially since we're juggling multiple time zones here. And I know that there's some environmental conditions on your end affecting the bandwidth. So I'm glad we were able to, you know, stay connected long enough to pull all this off. It's always a blast to talk to you about the game design thoughts and philosophies that you've got. And I really enjoy you sharing those with us and appreciate you taking the time to do that. So thank you.
Thanks. Thanks, Brent. It's always a great pleasure to talk with you guys anytime.
Yeah. So audience, hope you've enjoyed this chat with Brian. If you've got questions, throw them in the comments down below or in our forums and we'll try to get them answered. We might get Brian to stop in and answer them, or maybe we may relay the answers back and forth. But please, you know, drop a note in there. If you see us at a convention, odds are we're going to have one of the Brief Border Wars games, maybe both sets of them, with us in the Dragoons library that we've got there. And so that'd give you an opportunity to take a look at one of them and give them a play. But Brian made it a point, and we've got his website linked to this episode. He's got a bunch of print and play games available through his website, and they show off some pretty nifty design techniques and some different and unique ideas where Brian has spent 30-ish years or more at this point designing stuff around irregular warfare and a lot of interesting perspectives on it. So avail yourself of those resources, and there's some cool stuff to see. Guys, thank y'all very much. Audience, thank you for joining us. We'll catch you next time on another episode of Mention and Dispatches.